A band at the top of the world, a frontman gone overnight, and one question no one dared to ask. Was this the end of AC/DC? What happened next is one of the greatest stories in rock and roll history. It's a story that turns tragedy into triumph, silence into the loudest comeback imaginable. From the shock of Bon Scott's sudden death in February 1980, AC/DC channeled their grief into an album that would change everything. Released just months later, Back in Black wasn't just a record. It was a roar of defiance that resurrected a broken band and became one of the best-selling albums of all time. To understand the comeback, you have to understand what they stood to lose. By the end of 1979, AC/DC was a runaway freight train. After years of relentless touring, their sixth international album, Highway to Hell, had smashed into the American charts. It was a masterpiece of raw, stripped-back rock, and its success was monumental. They were selling out arenas, earning a reputation as the most powerful live act on the planet. At the heart of it all was Bon Scott. He wasn't just a singer, he was a rock and roll poet.
Much of the band's success, particularly in their live persona, was due to their charismatic frontman and lyricist, Bon Scott.
You've got to keep your eyes and ears open for lines and words and all, you know, and ideas and just pictures, you know?
His lyrics were clever, full of wit and cheeky stories about life on the edge. On stage, he was a magnetic, swaggering force of nature. He was the voice, the heart, and the soul of AC/DC. And the band was on the verge of becoming the biggest in the world. Then, on the 19th of February 1980, the rock world stopped. Bon Scott, just 33 years old, was gone. After a night of heavy drinking in London, he was left in a car to sleep it off and was found lifeless the next morning. The official cause, acute alcohol poisoning, death by misadventure.
Bon Scott was discovered last night in the car. Scotland Yard spokesman said specifically that there were no suspicious circumstances surrounding Bon Scott's death.
Well, everybody's really shocked, and they were in pre-production in London at the time for their forthcoming Atlantic album, so things have been put on hold for a while. Everybody's really shocked. And the band will continue, there's no doubt about that.
For the band, the news was world-shattering. Their brother, their leader, was gone. The music died. Without him, the band was staring into the abyss.
Bon Scott's death just stopped them dead in their tracks. Here they were at the peak of their game, as more popular than they'd ever been, selling more records than they'd ever sold. They can see the rewards coming from all the really hard work they'd put in with Mutt Lang on Highway to Hell. And suddenly, bang.
Days turned into weeks. The band was broken. But then came a message from Bon's parents. Carry on. He would have wanted it that way.
That was kind of the stepping stone that they needed to be able to get back to work, because his mother said to him, Bon would want you to carry on.
So, reluctantly, Angus and Malcolm Young began the impossible task, the search for a new singer. How do you replace the irreplaceable? The search led them to a name from their past, a man Bon himself had once praised. Years earlier, Bon had seen a singer named Brian Johnson performing with his band, Geordie. Partway through the set, Johnson had screamed so hard he collapsed on stage, later diagnosed with appendicitis. Bon was blown away, telling his bandmates, "That guy's incredible, he's the real deal."
Bon Scott himself unwittingly told the boys, he said, of all the rock singers I've seen in England, there's this kid called Brian Johnson who played with when he was in the other band.
Yeah.
And we played together, and we got on well, me and Bon. We just had a pint, and we went our separate ways, and I never
right.
saw him again.
But that's very generous of him to go
around.
It
was very nice of him.
But by 1980, Brian Johnson's rock and roll dream was over. He was back in Newcastle, fitting vinyl roofs on cars for a living. When the call came from AC/DC's manager, he didn't believe it. but he agreed to a tryout in London.
So I got the telephone call in my office, and this woman said, is this Brian Johnson?
Yeah.
And I went, who's this? And she went, this I cannot say before, because I'm phoning for you must to come to sing in London.
It was a German woman, I think.
Yeah. And I said,
it's top secret.
I said, well, for which band? She said, I cannot tell you this.
Nervous, he walked into the rehearsal room. To break the ice, he asked if they could play the Tina Turner classic, Nutbush City Limits. The band grinned, kicked into gear, and Johnson let loose. They were stunned. Then they asked if he knew any of their songs, and Johnson sang Whole Lotta Rosie.
That's when I went down and met the boys. We sang two songs or something, and then there was some nods and smiles, and I guess it was just this wonderful moment when, you know, the stars align or something like that.
He had the job before he even left the room. His blues-soaked powerhouse voice was the perfect fit. But finding a singer was only the beginning. Now they had to create. The band flew to Compass Point Studios in Nassau, the Bahamas. But this was no tropical holiday. From the moment they arrived, the island was battered by relentless tropical storms. The weather was a mirror for their grief. The storms knocked out the power constantly, forcing them to work by candlelight. It was a sign. Nothing about this album would be easy. Driving them through the chaos was producer Robert Mutt Lang. He was a sonic genius, but also a drill sergeant for sound. He pushed the band for a perfection they had never known. For Brian Johnson, the new guy, the pressure was immense. Lang made him sing every line, every word, over and over, until his voice was raw, searching for the perfect take. The best example was the album's opening track. Lang wanted a sound that was epic, somber, and heavy to set the tone. He wanted a real church bell. They tried recording bells at a nearby church, but the sound was ruined by the frantic fluttering of pigeons.
We set microphones up in the bell tower, and we very quickly found that was a huge problem. Bell towers also have birds living in them, and every time we hit the bell, the first sound you heard was the fluttering of 250 birds flying off into the Leicestershire skies.
So they commissioned their own, a £2,000 custom-made bronze bell from a foundry in Leicestershire, England. They recorded it, and it became one of the most iconic openings in rock.
Can it be AC/DC? If a guitar comes in here in a minute, it's unbelievable. It is.
It's a good set list here.
It's Hell's Bells. AC/DC.
Oh, into a bit, man, of that.
Can it be a bit AC/DC, man?
It is the best opening track of any album ever. So it's such an ominous bell. And it says so much.
In just 6 weeks, against all odds, they turned despair into the heaviest, tightest riffs of their lives. The album they created was a masterclass in hard rock, where every track served a purpose. Hell's Bells, with its tolling intro, was a direct address to the tragedy. It was a funeral dirge that, as the riff kicked in, transformed into a defiant statement of power. Then there was You Shook Me All Night Long. It was the lead single, a fun, loud, and incredibly catchy anthem. It was the crucial signal to the world that AC/DC could still be the life of the party. It proved Brian Johnson could handle Bond's cheeky swagger, and it became their first ever top 40 hit in the US. And then the title track, Back in Black. Malcolm Young's riff is legendary for its simplicity, its groove, and the spaces between the notes. It's a rhythm that's impossible not to move to. Lyrically, it was Brian's mission statement. This wasn't a song of mourning, it was a celebration of Bond's spirit, the fearless, wild energy that defined him. Lines like, forget the hearse, cause I never die, were a defiant shout against death itself. The album was done. The tape left the studio. The world was about to find out if AC/DC still had a future. The album dropped in July 1980, and the explosion was immediate. It hit number one in the UK and number four in the US. But it didn't just climb the charts, it lived there, remaining on the Billboard 200 for over 5 years. Critics were stunned. They praised the album's raw power and sonic brilliance. More importantly, they praised Brian Johnson, hailing him not as a replacement, but as the perfect new component in the AC/DC engine. The real test, however, was the stage. The subsequent world tour was massive. Every night, Brian had to win over thousands of fans, singing not only the new anthems, but also the beloved classics that belonged to Bon. And night after night, he did. His powerful performance and humble attitude won over the entire fanbase. The new AC/DC was forged in the fire of that tour. Today, Back in Black has sold an estimated 50 million copies. Its sound became a blueprint for 1980s hard rock. Its songs are embedded in our culture, blasting from sports stadiums, movie soundtracks, and radios across the globe. If you want to hear the full story of Brian Johnson's audition for AC/DC, just click the thumbnail on screen now.